Welcome to Witness to Yesterday, the podcast of the Champlain Society. My name is Larry Ostola, and today I have the pleasure to speak to Robert Lower, the author of Unsettled, Lord Selkirk's Scottish Colonists and the Battle for Canada's West, 1813 to 1816, published by ECW Press in 2023. Bob Lower wrote, edited, and directed films in his hometown of Winnipeg for over 50 years. A veteran of dramas, commercials, and fact-based films, his first and abiding love is for documentary, in which he made or contributed to films for the National Film Board, CBC, and History Television, among others. His fondness and fascination for Canadian history is reflected in his films and reached a peak in his last directing effort, 2014's Shameless Propaganda on the Second World War origins of the National Film Board of Canada. Writing has always been at the center of his approach to documentary, for which he's received many accolades, including a Writers Guild of Canada Award for Best Writing in a Documentary Film. Bob, many thanks for joining me today, and it's great to have a chance to speak to you.
I'm delighted to be here.
So your new book, why don't we start right at the beginning and start with Lord Selkirk. Who was he, and what sparked his interest in establishing a settlement near present-day Winnipeg on the banks of the Red River in 1813?
His name was Thomas Douglas, and he was the fifth Earl of Selkirk. He had to have four brothers die for him, childless, for him to inherit the earldom. So he didn't expect to be an earl, so he educated himself and was quintessential product of the Enlightenment. He witnessed the French Revolution, and that gave him an abiding loyalty to the British class system. He did not like what he saw happening in the Terror and afterwards. So he was not a Democrat, never pretended to be a Democrat, but his Enlightenment education meant that he thought a poor people's lot could be changed by structural methods. I mean, by structural, I mean he saw the problems as relating to overpopulation, poor land, bad masters, things like that. And he thought that people deserved a good life and they could be given that by changing the conditions of their life. And overpopulation was an issue in Scotland and Ireland in those days. So he had already done a couple of experiments in starting colonies, one in Prince Edward Island, which was quite successful, and another in Southern Upper Canada, now Ontario, which wasn't very successful. And he heard about this beautiful spot, agriculturally glorious spot on the prairies of Western America, as he called it, the Red River. He'd never been there. He had no reason to go there, but he believed his informants, and so acquired essentially a controlling interest in the Hudson Bay Company, using his own fortune and that of his wife's, to grant himself control over a significant portion of Rupert's Land, which was what the Hudson Bay land grant was called. And he started around 1810 looking for ways to get people over there. And he saw the need in the people who were being displaced by the clearances. And he put those two things together, and he himself never went there until 1817, but he sent Miles MacDonnell, who he called the governor of the territory. He sent him there, I think, in 1811. Well, I know, in 1811. And the first group of colonists followed him in 1813.
In your opening remarks, you referenced the lot of the Scots in the Highlands, but why don't we turn to North America? Because the Scots who made their way to North America really had to endure enormous hardships in their quest for a new life. I was particularly struck by your description of the route that was traveled between York Factory and the Red River. It seems to have been particularly grueling and almost unbelievable in today's context. So tell us about their journey and how they eventually arrived on the banks of the Red River.
Well, There, first of all, they'd had to spend an entire winter outside Churchill, now Manitoba, in really hard conditions, then walk in April, which is still winter there, across from, I think, 250 kilometers to get to York Factory, where there were boats waiting to take them up to Red River. The trip is about 1,200 kilometers. 50 of them were packed into two open, what we would now call York boats, which are around nine meters long. They could comfortably probably seat 10 people. There were 25 in each of these wooden open boats being rowed and pulled. They called it tracking when you put a rope over your shoulder and haul the thing along the bank. Upstream all the way to Lake Winnipeg, which is around 400 or 500 kilometers of pure wilderness, mosquitoes, predators, windy rivers, rocks, 33 portages in which they had to empty the boats, carry them, each one weighing 1,000 pounds, 500 kilos, across anything up to several kilometers of land. Their women and children. There were no babies born on this trip, but there were small infants. And it took them about 20 days to get from York Factory to what is now Norway House, then Jack River, near the shoreline of Lake Winnipeg, and then another couple of weeks to do the length of Lake Winnipeg. They got lost. They had storms. Nobody died. It must have been incredibly grueling, but these were seriously, and it would be shown over and over again in the next 3 years, they were seriously tough people. They were Highlanders, farmers, and nothing about their lives had been easy, and this was a real test, and every one of them passed it. It's a wonderful thing. As you come down Lake Winnipeg, you've got the boreal forest all the way down, which is a very forbidding place for anybody thinking about farming. And then just as you reach the mouth of the Red River, the prairie spreads out before you with these, you know, with recognizable trees, recognizable bushes along the bank, lots of waving grass and land that doesn't need clearing. And it must have just been a wonderful thing to see that and to arrive there in June of 1814.
Well, and it is a remarkable story, a story of endurance, as you've just described to us. But it's more than just a story for you. In the book, you made reference to a direct personal connection. Tell us about Samuel Lamont.
We had a family story that we had a Red River Selkirk settler in our background, but for some reason I'd never pursued it much. And I think I didn't quite believe it. But a plaque was raised on the shores of the Red River with the passenger list of that first group of people from the ship who carried that first group of people. And there was this man named Sam Lamont, and that's a family name of mine in my past, my mother's side. And I thought, I wonder. So I go on the net, and it wasn't very hard to find out that he was my great-great-grandfather. He came from the island of Islay, which none of these people were islanders. He was hired by Lord Selkirk. He was 22 years old, presumably recently out of his apprenticeship and into being a journeyman millwright, builder of mills. And he was hired by Lord Selkirk to build a mill for the Selkirk settlers. So he came with them. And so I got very interested, went down to the archives, started looking for references to him. And that's when I realized what a fabulous story this whole thing was. But that's my connection.
Yeah, that's just fascinating, and it really, no doubt, makes the story come to life in a very personal way for you. But the Scots arrive in early 1814, and almost immediately, tensions begin to build between them and the employees of the Montreal-based Northwest Company, who were located nearby. All of this culminates in desertions and in the destruction of the settlement the next year, so it had only been in place for about a year. What led to the tension? What happened with the Northwest Company?
Northwest Company, when you say they were nearby, it's important to know that the Forks was not, I think they expected an empty land. You know, nobody's there. First Nations don't count, but in fact, it was a busy place. There weren't many people settled there, but there were nearby First Nations in every direction. There were Métis, both settlers and itinerant. They didn't call themselves Métis at that time. They called themselves Bois Brûlés. And so that's what I call them in the book. It was a busy place, and where their settlement was headquartered was only about, I guess, 2 kilometers from the fort that was the Northwest Company's chief fort in the West. The Northwest Company was a deadly rival. I mean, it was really life and death at this point commercially. A rival of the Hudson Bay Company. They identified the colony with the Hudson Bay Company because they'd been granted their land by the Hudson Bay Company. They were not happy about this colony being established there. They came to a temporary truce, actually shortly before the settlers arrived. The Hudson Bay Company and the colony officers came to a kind of truce. For the whole summer, they coexisted in relative harmony. It was a lovely summer, actually. It was a beautiful, the weather was beautiful, the land was beautiful. These people were distributed on the land in a way that was very satisfactory to them. They were very happy people. The Northwest Company began immediately trying to undermine their loyalty to the colony. And later in the fall, when the Northwest Company, it's funny, because the Northwest Company arrested the man who was called their sheriff, who was very popular in the colony. And when they tried to rescue him from the Northwest Company, their own officers prevented it because foolish notion of gentlemanly conduct. And this precipitated some antagonism between the officers appointed by Selkirk and the colonists on their own. And that antagonism grew as the winter went on, as the fall turned into winter. Conditions got bad. It was their first winter in Winnipeg. And as a guy who spent 60-some winters in Winnipeg, I can tell you that must have been a brutal surprise. And as they got into that, the settlers needed more and more help from the officers and the stores of the colony. And the officers in charge of the stores became meaner and nastier about giving that help. And the result was this climbing antagonism between the officers and the settlers, which the officers did nothing to diminish. They never tried to negotiate or conciliate the settlers. They acted like their overseers and landowners had in Scotland, and behaved very arbitrarily. Well, the Northwest Company was seeing all of this, picked up on it. Very, very clever guy in charge of the Northwest Company there, a guy named Duncan Cameron, who just weaseled himself in, offered any settler who was dissatisfied free passage to Upper Canada, which was settled, and promised them free land there. And slowly but surely, over the winter, one thing piled on another, until finally the settlers were openly rebelling. And there's a very, very dramatic confrontation in May and June between settlers and their growing ally in the Northwest Company on one side, and the officers of the colony on the other. And so, and in the end, about 80% of the colonists from a year before accepted the offer and went to Ontario with the Northwest Company. But the upshot was that the agents, the employees of the Northwest Company, who were generally Bois Brûlés and who believed the colony to be their enemy, burned the colony, burned the houses, burned the their central compound, and drove them off back up north to Jack River. And it looked like the colony was all over.
Yeah, that's quite a start to the enterprise. But one thing I'd like to touch on is you referenced the intense rivalry between the Hudson's Bay Company and the Northwest Company, and it's really central to the story of the Red River settlement. And in one chilling letter that you reference in the book, an employee of the Northwest Company named Alexander McDonnell wrote the following: One thing is certain, we will do our best to defend what we consider our rights in the interior. Something serious will undoubtedly take place. Nothing but the complete downfall of the colony will satisfy some by fair or foul means. A most desirable object if it can be accomplished. So here is at them with all my heart and energy. In that kind of a context, was any kind of peaceful coexistence a pipe dream?
Oh, absolutely. Because they come to this sort of accommodation the June before, this temporary accommodation, as usual, it's not the people who are involved who could see a way of getting along with this colony. But the people back in Montreal, the leaders of the Northwest Company, mostly Scots themselves, would have none of it. And they gave them strict orders. And by fair means or foul, they meant anything it takes. And in those days, that was even more extreme than it would be now. And so from then on, if the local leaders of the Northwest Company wanted to keep their jobs, their job was to get rid of the colony. And that was their focus all winter long. And as I say, Duncan Cameron did it in a very clever way. But then, to his shock and horror, another group of colonists arrived, and the original colonists came back, and they started all over again in August of the same year, 1815.
So one aspect that was really interesting to me was the attitude of Chief Peguis of the Salto Anishinaabe people. In the book, he proved to be a friend and supporter of the settlers. And I wonder, was this simply a case of his opposition and his people's opposition to the Northwest Company? Or do you think there was more to it than that?
I think he was a very special person, obviously extremely intelligent. He was an open and welcoming and accepting human being. We see that in that in the vignette I have when he goes north with Miles MacDonnell to visit York Factory and see an ocean-going ship for the first time. He's nothing but curious. He is so eager to find out about this and to participate in this. He goes and visits the ship and is absolutely fearless in his questions and his befriending of the ship's officers. He was a really special man. Plus, he had been treated badly by the Northwest Company, and he had not yet been treated badly by the Hudson Bay Company, mainly because the Hudson Bay Company didn't operate in southern Rupert's Land very much. It was the Northwest Company's place. Anyway, he was still willing to give them the benefit of the doubt, and remained. Also, his people had only come there, had only come to where they were settled, which was right on the southern shore of Lake Winnipeg. It was in his lifetime that they had arrived there from as a breakoff element of their tribe in Minnesota. They had started to overpopulate that area, so they came up. They found an uninhabited area on the south end of Lake Winnipeg. They were fishers. They weren't buffalo hunters, so they weren't competing with the local First Nations. And so I think he felt the fellowship of the newcomer.
Well, and you touched on this, but almost unbelievably, despite what you described earlier, under the direction of a Hudson's Bay Company employee, Colin Robertson, the settlement actually gets reestablished again in 1815. But the Northwest Company, and you also alluded to this, the Northwest Company is not backing down. And less than a year later, in June of 1816, there's a major disaster when there's a bloody encounter at Seven Oaks. Describe the scene for our listeners.
It's important to know that technically, Miles MacDonnell and the governors of the colony had forbidden the export of pemmican from the colony because they needed it for the settlers to survive on during the winter. Pemmican was the lifeblood of the Bois Brûlé traders, and they could not tolerate the notion that they weren't allowed anymore to take pemmican from wherever they wanted it and take it. And rightfully so. That was a reasonable demand on their part. There wasn't the slightest possibility that Miles MacDonnell could have enforced that ban, but the Northwest Company very cleverly seized on it and sent emissaries, and in particular Cuthbert Grant, who was a very charismatic young Bois Brûlé leader, out into the as far west as is now Alberta, recruiting Bois Brûlé to come and attack the colony, to save their, in their mind, culture, to save their jobs, to save their livelihood, and to eject these people who he had convinced them wanted to enslave them. There was never any consideration of that on the settlers' part. But reasonably, these people, especially the ones farthest from the actuality of Red River, believed it. They came across and gathered at what is now Portage la Prairie, and about 80 of them in June of 1816, about 80 of them set out to displace the colony. They had intended to arrive at Red River in secret and overnight surround the fort where they were expected by the colonists. So the colonists had gathered in Fort Douglas, and they were intending to surround the fort and just take them by surprise and make them leave. I don't think they intended to massacre them or anything like that. They were seen. So it's June 16th, and they were seen crossing the prairie, this band of about 80 heavily armed horsemen were seen by watchmen at the fort. The governor, Governor Semple, a recent arrival, not Colin Robertson, he had left by that time. He understood frontier life perfectly. Semple knew it not at all. He was an English import. He gathered together 20 men and 6 of his officers, the men we've been living with for the whole book up till now, and went out to confront them. For some bizarre reason, they took muskets, but not very much ammunition. They didn't wait around to take. They had cannons, and they were advised to take a cannon with them. He wouldn't do it. He said he was just going out to talk to them. Well, why did he need 26 men if he was going out to talk to them, all of them armed? And it's inexplicable why he behaved so stupidly, but it was not out of character. I mean, he wasn't a stupid man, but his behavior toward the people who were already here was blinded by his class entitlement. So he took these 26 men. They walked out. They walked for an hour or so, and then suddenly came upon this armed group of mounted men who were coming down toward the colony. They weren't expecting to meet them that soon, but there they were, and these laborers and clerks, basically, that he had with him, advanced on these men, and the armed column that was coming toward them divided and didn't surround them, but split into two and formed a half moon around this motley little group. Now, there's about 80 of them. They've got muskets, pistols, swords, spears, clubs. They are armed to the teeth. Most of them are Bois Brûlé. Some of them are what were called Canadians, which means French Canadians, and two or three were First Nations. But the First Nations, no First Nation had any particular animosity toward the colony at that point. There's this confrontation. I can't imagine how terrifying that must have been to see, because these guys are seasoned buffalo hunters, and being a warrior was a big part of the culture of being Bois Brûlé in those days. And these guys are clerks and laborers and, rowers of York boats. Semple advances, and they send out a spokesman, a guy named Boucher. They ask each other what they want. Finally, Boucher says, "We want our fort," which the colony had taken over. They had taken over and expelled the Northwest Company from it, but then they dismantled the fort. So Boucher says, "We want our fort." Semple says, "Go to your fort." According to the transcripts, everybody seems to agree that Boucher said, "You rascals, you've destroyed our fort." Well, either rascals was a much nastier insult then than it is now, or that wasn't the word that was used. Anyway, Semple took great offense to that. You know, here was his chance. He's outnumbered, he's outgunned, he's outclassed, he's out everything. The only way out is negotiation. And what does he do? He grabs Boucher's horse's bridle and says to his men, "Arrest this man." Well, there was never any chance of that. Boucher jumped off the horse and ran back to the horsemen. There's a moment of silence, and then kapow. Somebody fired a shot. The consensus afterwards was that it came from the settler side. I don't know who would have done that, and certainly not on Semple's order, but there was a shot. And then there was a shot right back, and it got simple. Well, the first shot got an officer, a man named Holt, killed him dead. The second shot got simple and wounded him, knocked him down. And then these non-warrior companions rushed up and surrounded simple to see if they could help, because he was wounded. Well, that put them in a cluster. And at that point, the entire line of Bois Brûlé and Nor'wester employees, they leaped. They didn't fight from horseback. They leaped off their horses, and at that point, they just fired into this cluster. Then firing went on back and forth for a couple of minutes. I don't think it could have been more than 5 minutes, because these guns, they fire one shot, and then it's a long time between. And by that time, most people are wounded because they clustered and because these other men have a lot of guns and they're good shots. So virtually all of them, and five or six, get up to flee. And they manage to get away simply by running, getting into the river, swimming across the river, or taking boats across the river. At the scene, all these wounded and dead Hudson Bay men, there was only one casualty on the Nor'wester side, are scattered about the ground. And someone, it's not clear who, I mean, it was more than one person, but it wasn't everybody. But some group, it might have been a family group, there various people accused each other, went through and systematically killed everybody who wasn't already dead. They looted the bodies and stripped them. They heard the shooting from the fort. The fort's a couple of, I think it's 3 kilometers away from there. They heard the shooting, and then there was silence. And a guy who hadn't quite made it to the battle, but saw it in the distance, had run back, and he said, "It's all over out there." The fort, unfortunately, wasn't quite finished. There was a portion of the wall that wasn't finished. It was full of women and children and about 30 more men who were capable of shooting, handling a musket and things. They went through the night, worried that at any moment an attack might come. The people who had run came in and told them the story of what had happened and the disaster that had happened. And another man who had been taken prisoner by the Bois Brûlé was escorted down and released into the fort to convey the condition that if and only if they abjectly surrendered and promised to leave the Red River forever, would their lives be spared? If not, every man, woman, and child would be killed. The, de facto leader, a man named Alec MacDonnell, had no choice but to agree to their terms. And so once again, they were routed in great grief, and that was awful, but they were once again routed and sent packing again up to Jack River.
So an absolutely horrific encounter at Seven Oaks, and you point out, clerks and farmers trying to go up against experienced buffalo, Bois Brûlé buffalo hunters, and the colony once again meets with disaster. But prior to getting to the next chapter in the story, I'd like to touch on a lighter note. After Seven Oaks, you mentioned that word was transmitted to Lord Selkirk, who at this point is in Montreal. And there's a fellow in October of 1816 named Jean-Baptiste Lagomonnière. He goes on an extraordinary journey from the Red River to advise Selkirk of what has happened. What was the trip that he went on?
Little context. That was actually the year before. It's after the first time they were routed. And the colony came back. And they knew that Lord Selkirk was coming to Montreal and intending to come the following winter to cross to Red River. So this is before Seven Oaks. So this man, another legendary Manitoba pioneer settler, the name is now pronounced Lagomonnière with a D. Then it was pronounced Lagomonnière. And he was a fur trader, also a buffalo hunter, powering figure in that history and in the annals of the Bois Brûlé. He was a friend to the colony. He'd worked a lot with the Hudson Bay Company. And he was back at Red River in the fall of 1815. And Colin Robertson wanted Lord Selkirk to know that the colony had been routed and sent up to Jack River, but was now back. He, Colin Robertson, had brought them back, and there was a new group coming, and he wanted Lord Selkirk to know that and to bring armed men with him, because he knew this, that what had happened once would happen again if there wasn't an armed contingent of genuine soldiers. So he sent Lajoie with a bunch of letters to Montreal. October 17th, Lajoie leaves with, you know, the pack on his back, good pair of snowshoes, and starts walking to Montreal. But he doesn't walk there directly. Because he's going to run into the Northwest Company if he takes the normal route, because that was their route down along Lake Superior and the north shore of Lake Superior. So he goes south and goes down around the south of the Great Lakes, Lake Michigan, Lake Superior, comes back up, goes up through York, you know, York being now Toronto, goes up through York in Upper Canada and travels all the way up to Montreal, where he finds the Earl and gives them these letters. It's nice. In the original documents, there's one that says, received March 16th, 1816. And that is 5 days after Lajoie got to Montreal. It's a really neat thing to see. You see that evidence of that incredible walk you have in Colin Robertson's diary. You have, I sent him off today, October 17th. At the other end, you have March 16th, I got the letter, right? It's a wonderful, an amazing walk. Walking back later that year, he did get captured by the Northwest Company. That's another story. But he got back. He had a wonderful life here.
Amazing, and a long trip for sure in the winter on top of that. But getting back to the colony, Selkirk arrives, and under his direction, it's once again reestablished in June of 1817. And this time it's reestablished for good. It becomes the first permanent agricultural settlement in Western British North America. And in 1821, the antagonists, the Northwest Company, it disappears from the scene in a merger with the Hudson's Bay Company. For some, what happened at Seven Oaks is remembered as a massacre, and for others, it's really an attempt to halt the disappearance of a way of life. After doing all of this research and writing the book, which was it in your view?
It is whichever you want it to be, because I don't think Bois Brûlé, the horsemen who are coming, you know, I don't think the plan was to murder everybody. I don't think anyone would have shrunk from that either. It was a tough time in the Western prairies then. If you got into a battle with somebody, it was pretty smart to wipe them all out, because if you didn't, they'd come back after you. So, but I don't think that was the plan. And I think the plan was just to rout them, get them out of the Red River, make sure they stayed out, take over the area and not let them back in. But when the way things unfolded, and particularly, you know, even after they had lost and they were surrendering, those who were still alive were surrendering, at that point it turns into a massacre. And that's all that the descendants of the Selkirk settlers could see for 150 years. That very night of that battle, back in the encampment of the Bois Brûlé, a song was written that is still performed today on this brave and wonderful victory, that was a victory of their way of life over an attempt to destroy it. So right from then, it was seen as a victory and the salvation of a way of life. It wasn't, the way of life was never threatened. But it's like us and Vimy. Vimy wasn't as big a deal in World War One as it is to any Canadian student of World War One, right? It's like that. It became this symbolic victory, which, like any new nation, needs a myth to form itself around, and that was a perfect one. So I think it's still seen as a victory and the origin of their nation by today's Red River Métis. And, you know, who am I to say they're wrong? It's still seen by hardcore descendants of Lord Selkirk's settlers as the massacre of the innocents. And who am I to say they're wrong? You know, so it's what you want it to be.
Well, on that note, Bob, I'd really like to thank you very much for our conversation and thank you for joining me today.
Oh, my pleasure.
My guest today was Robert Lower. His book, Unsettled, Lord Selkirk's Scottish Colonists and the Battle for Canada's West, 1813 to 1816, was published by ECW Press in 2023. You've been listening to Witness to Yesterday. Please visit our website at www.champlainsociety.ca. The best way you can support this podcast is by becoming a subscribing member of the Champlain Society. If you like what you've heard, let your friends know by forwarding this podcast through the social media of your choice. You can also send us an email at info@champlainsociety.ca. This podcast is made possible by the members of the Champlain Society who work hard to bring to life original documents in Canadian history. We want to thank the L.R. Wilson Institute of History at McMaster University, as well as a consortium of Canadian scholarly book publishers that includes the University of Toronto Press, UBC Press, McGill Queen's University Press, the University of Regina Press, and the University of Ottawa Press. My name is Larry Ostola. This interview was recorded on February the 27th, 2024. It was produced by Jessica Schmidt and supported by the University of Toronto Press Journal team, who also support the Champlain Society.